Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. We are all born into this world in a state of high dependency. Even before birth, we are dependent on and influenced by the world inside and outside our mother's womb. To help us deal with the inherent dependency on others, we are equipped with an extraordinary capacity for learning and understanding the world into which we are born. That capacity lays out a task for the world into which we are born, in particular for the people immediately around us before and after our birth and during the hours, days, and years that follow. If they have important, meaningful, and comprehensive insights into our evolving needs and capacities and gifts, then our ability to fulfill our full potential is assured. If this is not the case, then we must learn lessons in our lives to correct the misapprehensions that we carry from our early days. Our guest today has a deep understanding of these matters and of what is needed to give a new human being a good start on the trajectory of their future life. Darsha Narvaez is Professor and Psychology Emerita at the University of Notre Dame. Darsha has given a lifetime of study to trying to understand what a good beginning for each of us would mean. The title of a recent prize-winning book, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom, tells it all. She's going to share her knowledge of this critical aspect of life on planet Earth, knowledge which I believe has the potential to truly change the course of world history. Darsha, it really is wonderful to have you here today to join us.
Thank you so much, Warren. Wonderful to be with you.
Why don't you talk a little bit about emerita and if it has any meaning apart from a little structural change in life, because as I said earlier, retirement doesn't have much meaning. And emerita means a sort of a retirement. But how did that change your life when you became an emerita?
Well, I intentionally became an emerita so that I could do public education. So to work on nonprofit approaches to helping people find the evolved nest and re-nest. Sure. And what that all means. And so I am more focused on adults right now and trying to get them to alter their worldview and their practices in relation to children in particular, but especially babies.
Yes, indeed. Now, when I first went to your sort of website and I saw 40 pages of listed publications in your CV, I thought, this is a busy person. This is somebody who's been working at this for a while. Lots of collaborations, videos, community projects, all sorts of stuff. So why don't we start, you use the phrase evolvedness. Why don't we start with that core concept of the work you've done in the last 25 years that you've been at Notre Dame? So why don't you talk about that, what that means? What does an evolved nest mean? Now, I thought we could try, if you can manage this, imagine I was born, I'm imagining I was born into a family that had a truly evolved nest understanding. What would happen to me, Darsha? What would happen? What would my future be?
All right. Well, let me just say, we have two orders of the evolved nest. One for adults, so they don't get all freaked out hearing about it, and one for the chronology of the child and what they need to experience. So, which one do you want me to?
Let's do the chronology. I'm going to be a child. I'd like to be a child again, and you can help me with that.
Okay. So, hang on now. All the adults listening who didn't get the nest, breathe deeply because we can re-nest, right? So, all right, we start with Soothing perinatal experiences. That means that the mother feels supported during pregnancy, and even before that for her whole life. And the baby then has a relaxed womb experience. Birth is soothing, not forced. Timing is determined by the baby. Then the mother and child, the baby, are put together, are naturally skin-to-skin connected, which helps them calm down from all the mobilizing hormones of birth, and then bonds them. And then after that, the baby's needs are met immediately. So that's all soothing perinatal experience. Breastfeeding is number two. That's part of that experience. Our species, on average, for a millions-year-old existence, breastfed for about 4 years.
3 to 5 years, yep.
Yeah, and 2.5 years is related to peaceable societies. They do that at least that long. And breast milk is really a tissue. It's 80% alive, and there's so many good things about it. It shapes the jaw properly, which we're not doing anymore. So we have all these sleep problems and orthodontic problems. Then number three is multiple nurturers, because a baby needs 24/7 touch, holding, presence, responsiveness. And that's not just for mom to do. That's not how we evolve. We evolve communal child raising. And so those nurturers are of different ages, different genders or sexes, and they are there to immediately respond to that baby. And over time, the child, when they become mobile, they are also there to be supportive, but they allow for the freedom of that child to do what their inner moral and inner compass directs them to do, which is learning in ways that look so risky to us today. It's like, oh my God, don't do that. And you don't want to interfere. You want to let them follow their inner compass. And then there's a welcoming social climate, which is part of all this. They feel like they're part of the community, that they matter, that they belong, they have something to contribute, and they're ready to be community members little by little, more and more and more. Yeah, so you don't interfere with that. You don't interfere with a 1.5-year-old's desire to help fold the laundry, even though they'll make a mess of it, right? But they are in a sensitive period for wanting to be a contributing community member. If you interfere, later when they're teenagers, you ask them to take out the garbage, like, ah, or even when they're five, right? So then there's touch, positive touch, lots of affectionate touch. We need it to grow our bodies and brains well in all sorts of ways. And no negative touch, because that shifts the trajectory away from the optimal normal development, undermines the stress response system, the vagus nerve, and so on. Then there's responsiveness, responsive relationships. So these are, you know, they all overlap. Responsive relationships, you keep the baby calm in babyhood. And then throughout life, we all need mentors. We all need guidance from people who know more than we do.
All I can see is, I mean, I've been a family physician for a half century. All I can see is contented, small human beings all over the place. It's like, when I said in the introduction that I think this, if we all incorporated concepts like this in one generation, we could actually change world history, because we would generate a society where the fears and the anxieties that plague and beset people and slow them down would simply mean that they would be purposeful rather than free-floating or irrelevant.
So those are the six so far. Then there's three. These are the ones we start with adults when we talk about the whole nest. Mm. Play, self-directed, social, free play. This is a healing experience. It grows your right hemisphere, your right brain, which is the source of your true self, of all your capacities, who you are, you know, empathically, relationally, so much intelligence there. And then number two is healing, restorative healing practices regularly, which in our ancestral context would happen weekly. Or if you ask the San Bushmen, often do you have a healing service or part? This is singing and drumming and dancing and, you know, hours and hours of it. how often do you have it? Well, at least once a week. Unless there's grieving to do, then every day, right? So they know they have to release the emotions that otherwise get in the way of their relational attunement.
Right.
And then finally, number one that we start with adults is nature, immersion, connection, and partnership. We are nature, right? Yes. Get out there, lie on the earth, you know, hug a tree, and listen. Learn to listen to all the communications that nature has to guide us to being good earthlings.
Now, what you've just outlined is a universal, culturally embedded but not particular culturally related approach. It's embedded in empiricism. And one of the things that has happened, of course, all cultures, they all have their own way of doing things. They're often determined by social events that have affected people. You know, the entire Spanish nation in Spain speaking with a lisp because, you know, the king had a lisp. You know, that's not a good way to develop a culture. Talk about some of the cross-cultural sources that you turned to and found gave you guidance when it came to developing some of these patterns and ideas.
Well, primarily the hunter-gatherer civilization of Central Africa, Central and Southern Africa. So our genetic heritage is still held by the San Bushmen, the San peoples.
Indeed.
They've been around for at least 150,000 years, and their practices that they still maintain are the ones that I'm identifying, I'm mm-hmm. extracting. Mm-hmm. And then if you look around the world, indigenous or native peoples, First Nation peoples, often are practicing these things too, unless they become too rigidly hierarchical, which is the dominant worldview's view of how we are supposed to be. And this is rigid hierarchy, right? No. We evolved to be fiercely egalitarian.
Yes, indeed.
Practices for maintaining egalitarianism. And part of that is the nestedness.
And you know, you're actually almost directly quoting from Luke Kemp's recent book called Goliath's Curse. And he looks at 300,000 years of human behavior as best it can be revealed through archaeological and paleontological evidence. But the evidence is consistent, and it says exactly what we don't like to be dominated. But when we're out in the world wandering around, we like to see what's happening. We like to talk to people. We like to learn things. We like to collaborate. He calls our ability to collaborate our special gift, something that distinguishes us from many other creatures. Not that they can't cooperate, but we can do it on a grand scale and in multiple different ways. That's a new trend that's emerging in the kind of work you're doing and he's doing and many other people are doing. It's embedded in documentation and evidence that is deep and multifocal and multilateral and multidisciplinary when studies are made. It also assumes something, and I want you to comment about that. There's an essential goodness in us. There's an essential desire for doing a better job of being a human and trying harder to be ourselves, if you want to put it that way. Do you want to comment on that a bit?
Well, I agree with the ancient Greeks that we aim for the good in the moment, mm-hmm. whatever that is. Mm-hmm. We try to, in a way, cooperative. But if you were undermined in early life and forced into distress quite a bit, perhaps because your parents weren't supported with multiple nurturers, and all these other things that happen today, your neurobiology puts you into a self-protective state. Your stress response kicks in, and then your blood flow shifts to your muscles instead of your higher order thinking. You can't think very well. You're not going to be open-minded or open-hearted, and you brace against life. And if you're in that state, you have a hard time cooperating other than dominant submission. That's all you have because you're born with that, the innate survival systems, you know. And so.
Indeed.
All these adults now, that's the only way they know how to get along because they didn't go through the postnatal social emotional intelligence development
sure.
that we need from the nest in the first, especially 6 years and more for boys. They mature more slowly by about 2 years. So they need a lot more nurturing, more nest. So our cooperation is part of who we are, but it's nurtured by the nest.
Indeed, and the concept that you and many others have worked on developing, you're now working on spreading it around. so that others will start, as you said, adults, you're reaching out to adults. The Nesting Ambassador Program is one. Why don't you talk about that and how that works?
Yes, the Nesting Ambassador Program, we tested last summer with about 25 invited folks, a lot of therapists and others, mm-hmm. Nature connection people, and then we revised it and we launched the version for the public in January this year. And it's intended to help with the overview, the knowledge of the practices of the evolved nest, what then the principles, what's behind it, the neuroscience mm-hmm. that supports each one, and then also to give them some praxis to how to apply it in their own lives now. And then we help them develop a tool, whatever walk of life they're in, if they're a therapist, an educator, early childhood, a parent, or parent person, then they are able to develop a tool that they can use wherever they are. And so then we put them out on our website and you can contact them. We have a few already from our trial version.
And what's unique about this program is that it's based on universal structures in us and structures and flows of, you know, chemicals, whatever you want to call it, human physiology, anatomy, metabolism. It's not based on something local that worked for people in a particular community, but it's based on evidence that is universal in its application, which I think is an important point to make. Yes?
Yes, but these practices are uniquely applied in different cultures right around the world. So each native community listens to the land about how to treat the land, how to get along there with the creatures and plants there, and which myths and stories guide them to live well. But underneath all that, the evolved nest practices are all there. They're just manifested in different ways locally.
Well, it's like wearing different clothes, different uniforms, different skin colors. I mean, it that makes the charming diversity of the human project, as opposed to sort of universal uniformity, which would be extremely boring.
So it's the same values then, with different forms.
Absolutely. The forms are the surface, but the values are the substrate on which the surface is built. Now, the fact that it's based on human neurobiology and these other underlying processes, there are some really key parts of sort of turning points in this. Now, you mentioned the first 6 years, but even the first 2 or 3 years, there are critical processes that are taking place. Do you want to just outline some of the major things that are happening at that point?
Yes, I just reviewed Alan Shore's new book, The Right Brain and the Origin of Human Nature. And he points out in there, and he has kind of done this for a couple decades, how important it is those first 3 years, as you say. Mm. So the first 2.5 years, the right hemisphere is scheduled to grow more rapidly. And the right hemisphere, as I mentioned, is the seat of our true self, our sense of dynamic flow with life, our relational awareness, and all those
values.
Things. Yes, values, morality. Yes. And then around age 3, the left brain is scheduled to grow more rapidly. Now, if the right hemisphere hasn't been nurtured well with the nestedness in particular, but, you know, with at least parts of the nest, that right hemisphere is going to be very weak. The true self will be very weak. And so then when the left brain comes in, they don't have the strong partner, which should be the master, and they don't have that, then the left brain will come up with a false self and will dominate and berate.
At age 6... there's another milestone, the famous statement by the founder of the Jesuits, the Ignatius Loyola, give me a child before he's 6 and I will have him for life. What's going on around there?
Well, young children are in the theta brainwave state most of the time. They're just sort of in a hypnotic state where they're just absorbing everything, imitating, and building their view of the world, their worldview. Mm-hmm. If you punish them, you pull them out of that, and they start to then doubt themselves, doubt the world, distrust relationships, distrust, etc. And they'll be, well, the Nazis' child-raising manual, they want you to break the spirit of the child before age 3, because they wouldn't remember remember what happened, but you'd be able to make them conform,
yes.
obey, right? They'd be so scared, their stress response kicks in, and they go.
I remember reading a text from a psychoanalyst who was looking at child-rearing practices, and in the 19th century, well before the Nazis, there was German concept was to literally beat the devil out of the child, which just makes me shiver right here as I'm sitting at thinking about it. It's such a horrible idea, but it was the idea that children's initiative, if it deviated one iota from the expectation of parents, then you had to punish the child for doing that. What a way to create automatons and people who could not get in touch with their feelings.
Yeah, robopaths.
Yes, indeed.
But the thing is that they didn't understand baby development. Babies are resemble fetuses of other animals till almost 2 years old. And so the adults who don't know that say, oh, look at how selfish the baby is. They want me to give them milk or whatever it is, their breast, or, you know, want to be held all the time. Oh, how selfish you are. And so there's all this discourse in the past centuries about how selfish they are, not to break the spirit, right?
I remember a mother telling me once that her two-year-old was trying to subvert her, trick her into doing things. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, we got to do something about this. Now, there's another major stage, which everybody is familiar with. It's often characterized as a major challenge, and that is puberty and the major transition from being an interpretation of parental direction to having a clear sense of yourself. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so the brain, I used to be a middle school teacher, so I know these kids, but the brain kind of reorganizes itself then. So it's a great opportunity if the child wasn't nested. Okay, let's do nestedness now, because right. the brain will reorganize itself around friendship or whatever sure. those relationships. But yeah, the in our ancestral context, you would have initiation rites around this time, mm-hmm. and that would ensure that the child who survives these, sometimes they're quite difficult, would have a connection to the universe, to the cosmos, and find their purpose in a way in the community. So it's this humongous sense of experiences. One of the authors really helpful to read is Mali Doma Somme. He talks about his experience in the Dogara culture in Africa, what that's like. He reveals as much as he can, but a lot he can't. And then that ensures that individual is going to be a good community member as well. If you don't do that, you know, we have all these adolescents now who don't know what to do. They don't have a vision quest or initiation. They find hate talk radio or hate talk video.
Yeah.
And go down rabbit holes.
They resonate and then they start to disappear from human society. What we're talking about now is pathology, or what is identified as pathology, that occurs in young and older adults, but which is really the result of misdirection and misappropriation of psychological resources in very young children. In other words, it's not a disease, it's a problem that was created by strange and unnatural behaviors that were experienced when you were very young, and they deform your development of personality and social skills.
And they form gaps in the brain development that may not appear until later. Because the brain tries to compensate, you know, but you're building a very weak foundation. And then in adolescence, early adulthood, things start to collapse. And you can have anxiety, depression, etc.
Talk about play as essential to our development.
Oh, play. I love play. When I was a classroom music teacher, I used folk song games, education through music, developed by a Canadian. and we would play folk song games, and then you work with the music and all that. So I incorporated that into my other teachings as a Spanish teacher, as a college educator. But play helps you. It's, you know, being present to the other. Mm-hmm. In a way that's spontaneous, mm-hmm. that's fun and joyful, and it helps you actually grow yourself, your being, your beingness.
Sure.
It is the cure. It is the way we grow in childhood. We're growing our executive functions, our ability to stop and start action, to recognize with empathy the reactions of the partner, because just like puppies and kittens, if one of them gets a little too strong and they're whatever nipping the other, the partner will go, and we'll stop playing.
Well,
the partner will withdraw some of that aggression. So you learn to control your aggression. You learn to be responsive, you know.
Yes, yes. I was reading a description of it, and the value of play and the essential nature of play. Without play and understanding that play can occur at any time in your life, as opposed to being sequestered in childhood, which is one of the foolish things that we sometimes do. What about multi-generational exposure for young children? This idea of uniform age groups and that kind of thing, there's a big problem with that kind of exposure.
Yeah, as Barry Hewlett pointed out at one of our Notre Dame symposia on these issues, he said that cross-age living and learning is the natural pedagogy. The young like to learn from the older, and the older like to, you know, include the younger in our nested condition. And so that's that breeds then cooperation. Yes. When we put kids to the same age classrooms, for example, what do they have to learn from each other? Risk taking, competition, right? So it's very unnatural. And then they spend how many years doing that? So the multi-generational includes then especially the grandparents.
Yes.
They're oriented to babies and young children. They are the ones who are more flexible. The adults, the parents are, you know, oriented to doing community and cultural things to get their, you know, identity formed and everything. And they don't have the patience that the grandparents have. So you want to always bring the grandparents with the young children, and they get along so well because they're both coming. They're close to the spiritual, the unmanifest, because the children just came in and the elders are getting ready to leave and become something else.
Mm-hmm. I had a grandnephew tell his parents when he was about three, I'm so glad that I chose you for my family. And he just said it spontaneously. And this kind of free-form spiritual expression is such a wonderful thing when you see it in a child. And of course, you tell it to a parent. You don't tell it to another kid. You tell it to a parent. I think we're sort of collectively approaching a fundamental model based on knowledge, on science, on abundant evidence and experience, and qualifying experience, that is really quite a different thing from what's been done prior in all of the evolutionary processes that human race has gone through, which were always local, culturally influenced. And now we're coming up with sort of a consensus model for what being a human being actually is. It seems to me it's a pretty powerful thing, a powerful time to be alive, to be able to participate in this. What do you think of that?
I agree. Why we're here. We are here to help the transformation occur, right?
Yeah. And you said, I've got to find the quote. My first memories were of injustice towards children. And so this has been a central concern of mine for life, along with trying to figure out what is wrong with the world and how to fix it. I mean, in a sense, this is what you and a number of other people are starting to do. Ian McChrystie, various other thoughtful people. We're coming up with a sort of view that is relatively unassailable. It's hard to say all this evidence, this documentation, this scientific research is put in a cocked hat and send it out to sea. You know, we can't do that. We have to actually listen to it.
Well, yes, that's what I think. But there are the left brain oriented folks that say, we're making progress. This is the way it is. You know, we're on our way to Mars or wherever it is.
No names mentioned. No names mentioned. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Yes, there are the aspiring Martians among us. One place that you turned and others have turned to as a kind of corrective to this left brain fragmentary view of human existence was to our indigenous colleagues, if you want to call it, our indigenous friends and neighbors, I like to say, who live all over the world, and who the when the Europeans were getting ready to do a little world conquering with our big boats and our big guns, and we were sailing around saying, "We like what you've got, give it to us, or we'll have to kill you." That kind of world is coming to an end. But the indigenous peoples that we were ignoring had lessons to teach us, which we resolutely refused to pay attention to. But you have, and others, are starting to really recognize that we've cut ourselves off, not just from those indigenous peoples, but from a part of ourselves. Now, you and Wuhenkpe Topa wrote a book. The title is Restoring the Kinship Worldview. And it's sort of a ping pong game. And this gives sport a whole new meaning. The ping pong game, you and Wuhenkpe, sort of, you'd make a comment. There would be a quotation from an indigenous leader of some sort. And then each of you would sort of back and forth comments about your own understanding and experiences and research, etc. And I was struck by the fact that there was a quotation from Carl Jung at the beginning of the book. I don't remember it. It says, "The more uncertain I have felt about myself, the more has grown up in me a feeling of kinship with all things." In other words, the uncertainty. By the way, he wrote that. It was part of a book he wrote called Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which was actually a description of his own personal psychotic break. He had a psychotic episode, and he documented, because he was a psychoanalyst, he knew what he was going through, and he documented in exquisite detail all the pain and the suffering and the aspirations that were beyond, you know, achievement, etc. But it's interesting. He's describing becoming... It's sort of like the more you know, the less you really, the more you know you don't know, that kind of thing. Who chose that quote? Because it was interesting to me to see it there.
I think my colleague did, Wuhenkpe Topa.
Yes.
So this is the left brain, the shift to the right hemisphere. So when you're in the right hemisphere orientation, you don't have a solid sense of self so much as responding, and you are shape-shifting among others, and your self shifts too, depending on the context and who you're with and so on. So it's an indicator that rigidity that we often take with us, our identity, you know, it's my identity, you guys are threatening me, my identity, whatever it is, our ideology, really, that's that left hemisphere. It doesn't want to let go because it doesn't know anything. It's very stupid. It makes up all these things. I call it the ivory tower mindset, right? Yes. You just have all these ideas and models in your head, and oh my God, I'm so smart and all this. Yeah, but there's in a well-functioning brain, the right hemisphere is the one that's gathering all this wisdom and from the sensory immersion in the world.
Yes.
And it sends it over to the left hemisphere, and the left hemisphere makes some generalizations and after looking at the patterns, and then sends it back to the right hemisphere to see if it's veridical, if it's true or not. And the right hemisphere then will keep what's true and discard the rest.
Yes.
But in a poor functioning brain, the right hemisphere is not doing its job, can't. Mm. And the left hemisphere just gets off on its own little tangents and, you know, ideas about going to Mars tomorrow and all that stuff. Mm. So. So
I see the teacher of young children as you're waving your arms and, you know, okay, kids, here's how it works. It's wonderful. No, I'm sure you were absolutely lovely as a teacher because kids like that expressiveness, right? They don't want to see a wooden faced person.
My Latina self.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful thing being a Latina. So I thought we could just discuss some of the chapter headings because they're very relevant to what human development is all about, and they speak to indigenous understandings. First one I thought was the recognition of spiritual energies in nature. Why don't you say a few words about that? I think you probably have a few words to say about that.
Yeah. Well, nature is alive. Everything is alive.
Yes.
And we just, the left brain doesn't recognize that. It can't. It just isn't capable. But the right hemisphere knows this. This reminds me of Jill Volpe Taylor's book. She's a neuroscientist who has a stroke on the, I'm sorry, the left side of her brain. So it's yeah. And she can't talk.
Hmm.
And she spends months in the state of the right hemisphere, which is, you know, things are glowing and she sees relationships and dynamism and all this stuff, right? And she's aware of those spiritual energies in a way. She doesn't talk about that too much, but that's what it allows. And so when you have your fully functional brain, you have receptive intelligence to those energies, right? There's much more going on than what we can measure or touch or see. And so that's what it's referred to here. And the quote is about sending your child out into the world to, you know, get connected to the spiritual world, right? Wow, we're all thinking, oh, my God, it's so scary. No.
Playing a natural environment is about, it's about the best thing a child can do, it seems to me. I was fortunate, grew up in a city, but was able to do that because there were big vacant areas next to us when I was growing up, which are now filled up with housing, of course. Okay, what about an emphasis on community welfare? I'm thinking of some of these in the context of the 21st century in which we are now embedded. An emphasis on community welfare.
One of the things that is apparent in hunter-gatherer civilization communities is they have a high autonomy, a lot of freedom and independence for the individual, but they're always, they're in a sense of connection, that everything they do, they know is affecting everyone else because you're aware of, the right hemisphere is aware of all this. And so you don't act in a way that's going to harm the community.
Mm.
And if you start to do that and you do it too many times, they're going to expel you.
Yes. In Goliath's Curse, there's a story of the Khoisan people in the Kalahari. One of their hunters became he was a very adept hunter. He was very skillful. But he began to develop a very high opinion of himself and started to be unkind and rude and domineering towards others because he had this notion that he was superior to them. And the entire community stoned him to death. Now, I don't recommend that as a solution to a problem, an interpersonal struggle, but it does illustrate how separating yourself and seeing yourself as unrelated to the rest of your community and starting to inflict harm on the community because of that is something that is deeply offensive. And when you think of what's going on in our world today, a lot of volunteer violence and deconstructive behavior is clearly something that will not last. It cannot last because we cannot tolerate that more than for a short period of time.
Right. And so in hunter-gatherer civilizations that the anthropologists, I hang out with the Radical Anthropology Group of London,
sure.
They point out how the big ego, the inflation, is prevented.
Yes.
Among hunters, for example, you know, you tease the hunter and yes. say, oh, it's so small, it's not going to find a rat. It would be bigger. Da, 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 da.
Yes.
And then until the fellow laughs.
Yes.
And then they ask, why do you do that?
Yeah.
Oh, if we do that, he would become dangerous.
Yes, yes.
He must kill us. So they have these methods, right?
Sure.
That we kind of forget about. We kind of worship the dominators instead of realizing how dangerous they are.
The Inuit have the same behavior. If something really bad happens, they start to laugh. And gradually, there are very small communities, right? The whole community starts to laugh together, the whole family, your extended family, whatever. And the description of a tent dwelling that was burnt down and all the possessions of this hunter were destroyed. And he comes to the rest of the community and tells them what's happened. And one of them starts to laugh. And by the time it becomes infectious and they're all rolling on the ground laughing. At this particular time, there was an anthropologist watching them and she said, what are you doing? This is awful. And they said, well, yes, but if we carried that around, that feeling of upset, it would transmit from one person to another and we would soon have terrible things going on in this little tightly knit community. Now, one other thing that I titled that I was really struck by was responsibility emphasis. It comes near the end, a chapter in the book entitled Responsibility Emphasis. In our culture, there's this exact opposite tendency, this seeking after pleasure and personal satisfaction of our desires and having an emphasis on responsibility. Why don't you talk about that as a 21st century lesson that we need to learn from our indigenous friends and neighbors?
Well, I think when you're nested, fully nested, you develop a sense of responsibility just because you are treated with empathy and your response, empathic response, is received with gratitude, and you have this whole kind of intertwinedness, entanglement with everything. You're aware that you are related to the trees, the waterways, the animals, the plants. They're all part of you. Mm. And why would you do anything to harm you?
Sure.
Really, right? So it's just this whole sense of being, you know, in the flow of the circle of life, the everything cycling, and you're just part of it.
It's such a restorative vision. As you're speaking, I'm just sort of seeing all sorts of things in my mind's eye that elicit by thinking about it this way. Now, like everybody that we've ever interviewed on our show, you have had a circuitous path to arrive where you are now, and so have I. Confession. You were born and raised in Minnesota, which is in the news these days for all the wrong reasons, and into a Lutheran family, which had fairly strict ideas about what is, you know, the way to do things. And it was by culture, because your father was Puerto Rican and your mother was of European background. Third of four children, the middle child, which is an interesting position to be in. And your father was anti-science. You described him explicitly as anti-science. What was that like, that grounding for you in that family?
I wouldn't say my dad was anti-science. It was the religion that was anti-science.
Was he pro-science secretly then, when no one was looking?
We didn't really talk about it. I mean, but he was a scholar, so he did appreciate and practice empirical work,
How did he square that with a religion that didn't think that was the right way to do things?
Well, I don't know if he addressed that directly. We spent every third year, we'd spend a year abroad when I was growing up, and we would hang out mostly with missionary kids or missionary other Lutherans and such. And then we come back. But having those multicultural experiences really kind of, you know, shakes things up for a very fundamentalist religious perspective. So I think that was going on for all of us.
Yeah. Makes it hard to be narrow-minded when you're exposed to lots of different situations. Yes.
Right, and you have to keep, on your toes moving across the world.
Did you discern a difference between your father and your mother's, I mean, obviously, could you characterize what you saw as differences between their approaches to having children and to raising children?
Well, it's hard to say. I think they were good partners when I was younger. Hmm. Yeah, supportive.
You said that, and I quoted this earlier, but my first memories are of injustice towards children. Now, something happened to you that you experienced when you were about 2.5. Why don't you describe that? Because it's the sort of thing that shapes people's, you know, in very profound ways.
Well, I was the first girl, so I was daddy's girl. I was his princess, I think. And, he was very protective of me. And I was playing on the balcony in Puerto Rico. And my older brother took my toy, apparently. And I said, "Oh, daddy, he took my toy." So I expected him, you know, to go get my toy from him or something. But he flew, in my view, my recollection, flew into a rage and beat up my mother, which was not what I expected or wanted. And that just kind of just shocked me for the rest of my life. Mm. And then living in so-called third world countries where kids my age, street corners selling gum in rags and so on, instead of being driven to school like I was, it was like something's wrong. And then we go back to the States where there's overabundance and wastefulness and all this. I was just seeing the superficial things going on. Whereas, now I know they're probably more nested than the kids in the States at that time.
Yes. Yes, we are rewriting a lot of human history right now. We're in an age when empirical evidence is trashing some choice and well-run beliefs that are completely bogus, simply because they were developed by, say, a dominant culture, maybe a European culture or a European structure that was considered valuable. After that, you branched off into lots of different directions. You had a description, you said, the rug was pulled out from under me every few years, which I think is a wonderful admission of accepting that life changes are there, as opposed to sternly refusing to accept them. One of the things you did, when you went to college, you at first wanted to be a diplomat. What was going on in your mind at that point?
Well, I've been oriented to bringing about peace, right? Third kids are
Yes.
oriented, making the marriage, the parents live in peace, right? They're oriented to that. And so that's, what's wrong with the world? How can I fix it? Okay, I'll be a diplomat.
A diplomat in the sense of being diplomatic. Then you were a Spanish teacher for a while.
Yes, and I mean,
Teaching
sure.
was an important part of what you were doing for quite some time.
Yes,
How does that
that's
shape
true.
you?
Well, you're oriented to the needs of the other, right? And learn and how to encourage them and motivate them and be present to each student. So it's really a great learning experience.
And the younger they are, the harder they are to fool. They know when things aren't going well. They may not say it, but they see it.
Yeah, so you have to be playful and be present, right?
Hard to fake it. You actually went to a seminary. You actually went to a
Yes,
formal.
in my search for the answer.
Yes. Did you find what kind of answers did you find in the seminary, in a formal religious training program?
Oh, the problem with humanity, original sin. It's all just there, nothing you can do about it. You just have to, again, spank it out of the kids, right?
Yeah, so Christianity suffered from the Roman Empire taking it on as the state religion in the late 300s, and that's went downhill from there. Many people believe that that is the way it was.
Yeah, they selected one sect, the patriarchal sect, rather
Yes.
than the one that's governed by women, for example.
Oh my goodness, yes. Oh dear. I at one point in my life was at an all boys school for a few years, and it's a very peculiar experience. It's not a normal experience. I wanted to talk about music, and maybe we can close out with this because music is more than just sound. And there's some talk about that in the book that we were quoting chapters from, but I want to quote Inayat Khan, who is the first Sufi to come to the Americas and to Europe to talk about Sufi spirituality. And he said this in a book called Music, written in 1962. What we call music in our everyday language is only a miniature, which our intelligence has grasped from that music or harmony which is working behind everything and which is the source and origin of nature. It is because of this that the wise of all ages have considered music to be a sacred art. Now, you became a musician. You actually had a BA in music and were an organist, both in churches and in other settings. Why don't you tell me what your reflections are about music and what it really is?
Wow. Profound question there.
That's what we do. That's what we do.
Well, the music of the spheres, right?
Yeah.
Everything is, and I associate that with play, right? It's the inner entanglement of the sounds that we produce and the playfulness among them, right? The birds coordinate their sounds, the insects, and they're all at different levels of, I don't know how to say it, but the soundscapes, the landscapes that people have looked at, Brian Krause maybe, has used music as recorded music from different places, forests, rainforests, other ecosystems, and then can tell when it's been degraded because there's fewer sounds, there's fewer levels of different intercoordinated beings making playful music together. And it's quite interesting. That's the way the world works, that we are, we're vibratory creatures, right? We're vibrating our energy. It's coming out to others in our, you know, state. So the state of wisdom, the major religions and have said is wisdom is a state. You have to let go of ego, let go of fear, be receptive and open. And then kinship wisdom, indigenous wisdom is all about that too. And when we do it together, we let go of our own ego, we let go of our fear, and we join together in the singing, the dancing, the drumming. We are then contributing to the music of the spheres.
Oh, you know, that's such a lovely note. I was going to say note to end on, because that's such a beautiful thing. And the other thing is it's empirically based. It's a beautiful thing that is close to true as we can get, that all things are energy, all things are vibrational energy at a different speed or amplitude of vibration. That's what particle physics and quantum physics tells us. So it's not like, it's not just a poetic metaphor, it's also a true description of what is actually going on in the world. Darsha, it's been really delightful to spend some time with you today. Thank you for joining us, and perhaps sometime in the future we might have another conversation about the state of things. The world seems to be evolving in a rather interesting way right now, and we should probably do our best to help chart it, and if we have some comments to make about ways to do it a bit better, that'll be okay too. Anyway, thank you so much to being with us today.
You're very welcome, and everyone go and play now. Go play in nature. All right.
That's a really good idea. Thank you.